Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of the Heretics Hour with me, Carolyn Yeager, your host. The date is June 10th, 2015. I'm devoting this program and the next one coming up to a reading of Adolf Hitler's private talk to a gathering of generals and officers at the Plätterhof Hotel in Obersalzberg, very near his own home, the Berghof. This talk is published at my website, carolynyager.net, under the heading New Translation of Hitler's May 1944 Talk to Officers at the Plätterhof. I have written and talked about this so-called speech before, but a supporter requested that I get Ray Goodwin to read it in the study hour manner and do some commentary on it. Well, I recognized that was a good idea, especially because there is a book about this talk out there which misrepresents it, in my opinion. I was going to say misrepresents the speech. You're going to find that I go back and forth between speech and talk because I call it a talk, and I'll explain that in just a minute. So here's Ray Goodwin, ready to read this and help me comment on it. Hi, Ray. Thanks for coming on board.
Hello, Carolyn. Hey, my pleasure. My pleasure. I glanced over this when you sent it to me. When I read that, I was extremely pleased because to me it was right down the alley of the table talks study that we had, and talks by the Führer. This was just a little bit more refined issue, but, I really enjoyed the, translation by Carlos Porter.
I'm glad you're here, and I know we're going to do a good job on this, and people are going to enjoy it. But I want to give just a little more background. I had to get this speech from the Institute for Contemporary History in Munich, Germany, which I did. Well, I had to do that because I was using the translation that was done by Wilfried Heinck for Veronica Clark, or they did it together, but she has that copyrighted. She has it in a book called Hitler's Most Significant Speech. And so I was told I couldn't use that. And so because she has it copyrighted, that's the only translation, English translation, that I or anybody else I know is aware of. So in order to use it for myself, I had to get my own version of it. So I eventually did that, and I got it from the Institute for Contemporary History in Munich, Germany, where it is the only copy of it that I know of, and I did this with the help of a good German revisionist friend, and then Carlos Porter agreed to translate it for me, and he always wanted me to clarify, and now is my opportunity to do so, that I only sent him $100 for that job, which is much, much less than the going rate would be, and not much at all, but that's all he asked for. But I had said at the time that I first talked about it in a Heretics Hour program that I had put $500 into the speech and getting it ready for people to read and so on. And he didn't want people to think that he had charged me $500. He says, please tell people that you didn't give me $500. He thought it would be like him ripping me off because he does so much good work for revisionism. And of course, he's been a great revisionist for a long time already. He's done all his own work, but he does all this translation for free sometimes or for very little. He's a wonderful contributor in that way. I just can't praise these translators enough. Can you, Ray? I mean, what would we do without people translating this material from languages we can't read?
No, you got that exactly right. And since you did mention that, I wanted to just say a word of tribute to our dear friend that passed away in Austin back in April, James Damon, excellent translator. And, he contributed so much too.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I'm glad you brought that up because I did make a post about that, but he was a great guy, just so giving, so much humility, and he was an excellent translator. And I have quite a number of things on my website that were translated by him. Mm-hmm. And it's sad when these people are gone and we realize how much we depended on them and how much we gained from them. But translation is absolutely necessary skill, and we are grateful for all the translators. Mm-hmm. So, thanks for mentioning James Damon. And I want to mention that the previous translation and book that I've already referred to that has some serious errors that cannot be blamed on the person listed as the translator, which is Wilfred Hank, but is solely the responsibility of Veronica Clark, the author who was also part of the translation team. I'm saying this because I'm going to point some of these things out. I think it's important to understand that, in my opinion, she intended to mislead and misrepresent Hitler's meaning in this talk. And that's why I put so much emphasis and importance on this, because in itself, while interesting, as Hitler is always interesting, it's not a particularly important speech, or as she puts it, that it's Hitler's most significant speech. And in order to make her case, she had to make some changes, actual changes in the wording, and also misrepresent some of the things that he was saying and the meaning of them. So I want to make that point right in the beginning, Ray, that I agree with you that this is a really interesting speech. It reiterates, it contains many, many things that he said and talked about in Table Talk. Again, that was a series of him talking to his inner circle, you might say, that changed and was varied, you know, not always the same people, over the course of 3 years during the war. It gave a good representation of how Hitler thought, what he thought about different things. And it's very much the same in this speech, which is from 1944, or this talk. I'm going to explain this talk and speech thing right now, that one of the things that Veronica Clark changed in her translation was the word sitting. She changed it to standing. And we'll come up on that in this program today, because it's in the part that we'll be covering. But she changed that when Hitler said that he would not be sitting here before you if he had not done certain things in the past. But she changed it to, I would not be standing here before you if I had not done certain things in the past, in order to emphasize the idea that it was a speech, and not only a speech, but a very important speech. So you wouldn't give a very important speech sitting down. Yeah.
That's right.
Too much.
Informality versus the formal, too.
Right, exactly. That's a good way to put it. So that's why I make a point of this, and I just want to let people know that, if they don't already realize, that when you're a translator, you do not change anything in the text that you're translating. Just think about if they did. You know, we depend on translators to give us exactly what author that they're translating had said. And you can't make even small changes like that.
Yeah.
So this is just one instance. That's why I get this mixed up. It's hard not to call it a speech, because it's always being called a speech, but it really was a talk, because he had had these talks before. He's talking to the officer corps, and this is not the only time he gave a talk to these officers. So, okay, with that, and then we can bring up some of these things as we go along, but again, I concur with Ray that this is a really interesting speech, and I would say overall that the purpose of this particular talk that Hitler gave, and I'm sure others that he gave, was to overall counteract defeatism in the officer corps.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
What I found in these words was, so often, the essence of National Socialism, what it was about, why he started out on that journey. And now another thing that I wanted to bring up, if I understood in reading about this manuscript, it was written on paper that had been folded, and that occasionally there are creases in that paper, and the translator often had trouble. Some words were illegible because they happened to be in that crease, and they were marked as such. Like right here, right off the bat, it says two words illegible, you know. So occasionally I'll be mentioning that, and when the text is interrupted with the word illegible, maybe sometimes a whole sentence, well, I'll let you know as the text says.
Right. Right. And, you know, just to clarify here, Ray, we don't have any written or typed or anything copy of Hitler's notes or anything like that for this. I think it was mostly extemporaneous. He may have had a few points written down or something, you know, but mostly I think he kept this stuff in his head. And he knew what he wanted to convey to them. And it's a long talk. And he went through a lot of things that some people think, well, gosh, he was boring those officers to death. They had better things to do than to sit there and listen to him go through all this. But if you take a little more sympathetic view to Adolf Hitler, well, then you can understand that he was trying to persuade them that his policies at that point, which was a very, very difficult time, and they were suffering a lot of losses and so on, were correct, and why they were correct. And so he took his time and went through the whole thing. Now, whether he convinced them, obviously he probably didn't convince everybody that he was correct, but that's what his intention was, so that they should have faith and go forward with the idea of victory, even though things didn't look very good. Now, the thing about the illegible part, what we have here is a copy of the stenographer taking down what he said as he spoke, and which is what they were in the habit of doing. And so this is typewritten up by the stenographer, or, you know, this is what the stenographer took down. And yes, it was folded, and I guess it was folded for so long that in the same, just about the same place on every page has these, this dark lines, and, some words are illegible. Sometimes it's a lot, and sometimes it's, you can actually make out all of them out, but it's on every page. And so therefore, you know that sometime, I think, in the other book I was mentioning, I think sometimes they tried to make out what they thought the words were.
Yes.
And put them in there. So I asked Carlos Porter not to do anything like that and not to try to pretty up the language either. So it's a little bit dry sometimes. It isn't the easiest reading, which is why we need to do commentary on it, so that we would get exactly what Hitler said. And I didn't want anything that was, you know, a guess or a guesstimate like that, which she did do. But
the overall impression I got after I read this, as you have it broken down, part one, part two, when I finished the whole thing, I thought, you know, this came at a very dire time for Germany. They were losing the war on a couple of fronts and suffering bombings, you know, fire bombings, all this sort of thing. And to me, Hitler's words in this are a, for lack of a better phrase, a tremendous pep talk to his officer corps, and to stress something positive at a time when that is exactly what was needed. A positive step by the leader of the country to say, hey, now, you know, this is what this thing is all about. We're fighting for our lives today because we are defending this idea. So that's why it was so impressive to me. It was positive. It was a pep talk to the men when they were suffering defeat on the battlefield. That's probably the main reason I thought it was so doggone valuable.
Yeah, well, overall, I agree with you, Ray. Overall, you could call it a pep talk. But there's so much in it. He goes into so many areas that is, you can't really just say it's that. But it, but basically, that's what it is.
Very positive nature.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's let the listeners start hearing the speech.
Okay. The Führer. Although, gentlemen, it has certainly been talked about, I would like to make clear the purpose of the course I have taken. An enormous transformation has taken place in the German people. Perhaps the German people, who have all experienced it together, inwardly, are not quite as aware of it as our foreigners who are witnessing the results of this transformation at this precise moment. This transformation remained concealed because it didn't take place in the sense of a lightning-like revolution as in 1918, but slowly as an evolutionary process, two words illegible, from those who did not come into close contact with this transformation or whose contact with it was limited. This includes the officer corps in particular. To the extent that the officer corps came from the Middle Reich, Zwischenreich, it was unable to concern itself with these problems inwardly or to document such a concern outwardly. During this period, the officer corps was educated according to the slogan that they should be apolitical. This concept of being apolitical is somewhat contagious in itself. Namely, as long as the state is dominated by a lot of political confusion, when 19 parties are struggling against each other in a state and no one can be sure which party will achieve a majority, that is, which one will gain control of the legislative body from time to time, it's a matter of course that such a conflict could not be permitted to spread to the officer corps or armed forces. The armed forces cannot take sides in either direction or become divided in favor of tendency A, B, C, or D. And for a while, we had 46 parties in Germany. It is therefore obvious that during this period, the armed forces necessarily had to distance itself from this phenomenon, and that it actually did so. However, I can, verb missing, the armed forces, illegible, of the attitude of the people, from the load-bearing element of the spiritual principles of the spiritual constitution of the people, or from the state constitution in itself. That means the armed forces were once profoundly monarchical at a time when the state, even if already divided in its political leadership, was, in its representation, at least considered a monarchical state. For an officer not to be monarchical at that time was unthinkable. He had to resign as a matter of course, because in the end he can only fight and commit himself to the ways things were. The monarchy was the given as the actual condition of this German empire. Later, therefore, to avoid this conflict, an oath to the Constitution as such was considered the most important thing. But the Constitution is just a hodgepodge of individual provisions. It was not the result of any victory and therefore the representation of the thinking of a single party, but rather the substance of the Weimar Constitution was precisely to stabilize and guarantee the multi-party state. But for this reason, it was quite natural for an officer, because he was an officer, to be able to swear an oath to the so-called Constitution as something apparently and theoretically apolitical, something independent of parties, although that wasn't quite true. It was, however, impossible to obligate every individual man to it when the time came to dissolve the professional army in favor of a people's army, manned by soldiers who enlisted on a yearly basis after being mustered into service. The political influences and attitudes of the day were necessarily brought into the barracks with these men. Since one cannot expect a man who has grown up in a certain political environment and has been deliberately educated as an apprentice since the age of 10 or 12, and who entered a trade union or a political party at the age of 16, to abandon his political attitudes on the day he enters the barracks and suddenly becomes an apolitical soldier. That might still work in a state in which service consists of a militia, a very short term of military service. But one cannot assume that a man can repress his political convictions over the long term, not even for a year. That's impossible. A conflict would necessarily arise between the officer, who has sworn an oath to the Constitution, and who therefore has really only the state in mind, I'd like to say, and his men, who represent their own particular point of view, depending on which party they belong to. The result must necessarily be a discrepancy between the, and then there's an illegible word, of the officer, his influence, and the readiness and ability to accept responsibilities of the soldiers entrusted to him.
Now that's really an interesting paragraph, isn't it? And how would you sum up what he's saying there?
Well, he's saying that men, I don't care if they're officers or common soldiers or what, they're not going to change overnight into a mindset that says we're apolitical, we don't look at that political side, our job is different from that, because they have learned, they've grown up with this stuff, and they've formed their opinions, and they do have those opinions. So you've got people going in 100 directions then, politically or whatever, if that's the case.
Yeah, and he's talking about the people, a people's army, rather than a professional army, which had been, they would all have pretty much the same attitude in the professional army. But
that's
when you
right.
have a people's army, people, he's saying people are just coming from, you know, their life, their ordinary life, and they've all got, they're all affiliated with some political party or another, because that was common in Germany. And they had a lot of them. So he's just talking about how to handle this, really. What can be done? And he says there's something of a problem here.
Yes. The introduction of universal military service would have torn this problem wide open, the way it already was before the war in 1914. At that time, when the monarchy was the representation of the state, according to the Constitution, the practical fulfillment of this more representative form of government was more or less left to the parties. From before the World War in 1914, the situation was that the officer was necessarily drawn into this crisis. We have some dramatic and tragic examples from this period, after all. He was pulled into a crisis which he was unable to master. It's quite obvious that this problem cannot be solved by the officer, but rather that he will be the principal sufferer when the time comes to solve this problem. This means that when the state appears in a particular form to which only the officer can be sworn, whether it's monarchy or a republic, while this same political manifestation is itself being subverted, a tragic moment arises for the officer in the sense that he is illegible, obligated to something which in itself no longer represents unity at all. The officer is now compelled to create this unity himself, which he cannot, of course, do, in addition to all his other responsibilities. Now, I comment on that right there. That goes back to what you just said about the people coming in from all over with different political views and how that is going to, if not subvert, certainly throw your military operations into disarray. And so the officer then is called on, hey, straighten this out. Get these guys to acting as a unit and thinking alike, which the officer can't do. It says, of course, along with all of his other responsibilities, he shouldn't have to be thinking about the mindset politically of each of his individual soldiers. This means that he will increasingly evade political responsibility and withdraw into or plead the reservation of his so-called constitutional tasks. In other words, he will have increasingly less influence over the men entrusted to him. This may even suffice in normal times, but in times involving the most difficult trials, the pure drill book is enough, since ultimately that's what the officer's activity is restricted to, the pure drill book. In the long run, however, this point of view by itself can no longer hold this body of men together. It was no different under the Republic. But this does not prove that this problem has to be this way. Rather, it only proves the total untenability of the situation which we have gotten ourselves into, that is, of proclaiming a state possessing a certain political form. Only such a state can be arbitrarily attacked by its citizens and must allow itself to be subverted, since in this state, then, 3, 10, 20, 30, 40 parties are fighting with each other, and of course not, for example, fighting over goals of the day, but rather partly over problems affecting the essential fundamentals of the state, where one says, I'm a Republican. Another says, I'm a Bolshevik. Another, I'm a communist. Another, entire line illegible, I'm an anarchist, and so on. That is, they are struggling against the existential fundamentals of this state. It's impossible for such a state to exist over the long term, which is already subverted and eaten away on the inside in this way. Whether it's a monarchy or a republic doesn't matter. This is precisely why the German monarchy had so little resistance, just as little as any other republic today, which are also corroded by the same phenomena, in the same way. The officer cannot master this problem. That's obvious. For his part, he's no longer in a position to step down off his pedestal. He will always feel obligated to a certain form of government. But if the certain form of government itself is no longer uniformly accepted by the men entrusted to him, then he finds himself confronted by subordinates who are completely disunited, including in their opinions as to what the activities of an officer should ultimately consist of. It is obvious now that if such a question is to be solved in a reasonable way, then this situation is the most blessed situation which an officer could ever wish for, since this problem has been solved in such a manner that state and party life are completely identical. that the state doesn't represent a certain form which is rejected, affirmed, or attacked by members of the state, then the officer can finally take a position clearly and unambiguously. In assuming an obligation to the state, he is, of course, obligated to everything which motivates the state, supports the state, fulfills the state, and which identifies the state with its spiritual background, as well as with its subordinates at the same time. That is the situation today. But it is quite normal that a huge movement would be unable to, illegible, perhaps persuade or compel, every individual immediately and completely, without further ado, to adopt an apparently metaphysical point of view, especially when he, the individual, is in no way professionally or even officially required to do so. But gentlemen, generals, and officers, today this question has been decided a long time ago. It has been decided in a couple of states. It's been decided in a fascist state, but not fully implemented there. You can see the consequences of that situation for yourselves. A fascist state on the one side, and a still absolutely communist underclass, thirdly a royalist, decorative figment, taken as genuine, a military that no longer knew who it should obey, and in the end, the total collapse of the state.
And who's he speaking of? What state is he speaking of there, Ray?
Italy.
That's
Italy.
Right. I was going to say, yeah, and we got that out of table talk, too, because he talked about this a number of times, referred to it.
That's really neat, because when I read this, I was into it. I said, he's got to be talking about Italy. I mean, that's exactly what happened with Mussolini. And then at the end, speaking of Italy with your initials there, I thought, bingo. Very nice.
Oh, I had that on there already, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the things I put in a long time ago.
Yeah.
Well, I've got some new comments here in red, but I didn't know that, that one was on there. Yeah. Okay.
This problem has been totally solved in Bolshevist Russia in favor of clear, unambiguous positions on the part of the officer on all matters affecting the state, its doctrine as a whole, and at the same time an unambiguous relationship to subordinates, a totally clear relationship. In Germany itself, this process was unfortunately too quickly interrupted by war. Since you can really believe that the course we are on would perhaps never have been needed if the war hadn't come. Instead, the overall deliberate gradual education of the German officer corps would, exactly like that of all German soldiers, have taken place prior to their entry into the armed forces. It would have gone step by step, according to the procedures which I have considered correct here, that is, without smashing the crockery, without destroying what is good, but slowly and surely, nevertheless, would have reached the established objective. There's only one thing one can do in this struggle, therefore, and that is to attempt to make up for what's been lost. In so doing, in my view, the purpose of this talk is to say things which are not quite appropriate for the general public, because these things express the therefore and the why, which is very often not necessary in propaganda for the masses. In propaganda for the masses, I can draw conclusions without even having to say in detail why I must take a certain course. I must not say that. But it is important to give an explanation to the entire leadership corps of the nation, which includes, first of all, the officer corps. Insofar as it is only a question of the political leadership corps, it has always been my most important task to, illegible, blank it more and more in this direction. I would like to introduce the recognition of the fundamentals with the result that today in the political field, the entire movement actually reacts in a completely uniform manner all over the German Reich. When some political event occurs from time to time, a central directive from myself is hardly even required to bring about a completely uniform reaction on the part of the entire political leadership, because it's already been fundamentally, illegible, uniformly educated so that the reactions in the leadership corps are identical almost everywhere. as is the case in any good officer corps from a military technical point of view, whether it's in northern Germany, southern Germany, western Germany, or in foreign countries, makes no difference.
Yeah, you know, it seems like now he's saying that the political leadership has come to respond in a uniform manner through all the teaching and training and so on, you know, in the with the political leadership. And they are now able to do what the military leadership, if you might call it that, is has always been able to do, because that's always been the way the military is supposed to be, you know, it's supposed to be uniform. They don't have different opinions. They're not squabbling and so on about things. It seems to me that he's that's what he's saying there. I could be wrong, but
no. You know, your interpretation is very sensible, and I felt that way. I also felt like what he's saying right here is he's talking about the time when National Socialism is finally wedded to the state in that they are as one. And that's what he was saying. And once the folk have accepted the principles of National Socialism and realize it's for the good of the state that procedures and laws and all are going into effect for the good of the nation, and they accept it, they can see it right before them. This is good. This is good for our country. This is good for our people. Then you start to wash away the effects of these 40 political parties and this Mickey Mouse dissension over things that can only serve to bring harm to the state. So that paragraph right there was quite powerful for me.
Yeah, that's very good, Ray.
Thank you. So, it is now our task to speak in greater detail of precisely these things, which one cannot write publicly to the officer corps and its leadership, and of course to show practical examples of what the results are now and what they should be. That is particularly important today, since today we are exposed to many hard endurance tests, which, and it's illegible. Perhaps many of my officers will not often understand why I accept all these endurance tests, these blows of fate, so calmly. It's because of my deepest conviction that, illegible, success stands at the end of this struggle.
Well, and of course, it's funny that translation of whatever he said was endurance test, of course, meaning like he was meaning like military setbacks.
That's right.
And
yes.
Of course he's now going to explain how he's had all kinds of endurance tests in his life, not just military setbacks, so that's why they don't bother him so much.
Well, on that last sentence, I'm going to, instead of saying illegible, I'm going to throw in what I put in on my mind. It is because of my deepest conviction that our total success stands at the end of this struggle. What he's seeing that meaning is, as dark as things seem right now, there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. And then he goes on, what he says next is really important too.
The Fuhrer says, "This conviction has never ceased to be mine on my entire pathway before. And I may briefly address it because this pathway will perhaps explain why I am more determined than others, and why my confidence is completely unbreakable. It must be so, since, gentlemen, if I did not possess this confidence, then I would not be sitting before you now, and the German people as a whole would look very different today. In a purely superficial analysis, preconditions for my attitude are not there, do not exist. When I decided to become a politician in 1918, this was a complete transformation of my whole life. The question is sometimes raised, I must answer it quite matter-of-factly here, how did it come about that today a man can stand at the head of the German Reich and armed forces who is only a private first class in the World War.
Yeah, and you know, that him bringing that up, and it's, he did do that, you know, he knew that that's what they were thinking, of course, since a lot of them, you know, and he knew how that was, because he had made himself, well, he had to, really, he didn't really make himself, but it turned out that way. He made, you know, head, commander-in-chief of the armed forces. So, and there he had only been a private, so, He would bring that up because he knew they were thinking about that, I suppose.
Sure.
Yeah. And of course, in the paragraph before is where you read that word sitting. I didn't want to interrupt it. People have picked that up, I'm sure. But he definitely did say that he was sitting before them.
Right. And therein was your original right-on analysis that this was not so much a speech as a conversation.
Right.
Rather informally. He's sitting and talking to these fellows.
Although they're not answering. I mean, I don't think they would dare to say anything. They weren't holding up their hand and asking a question or anything that I know of. But they're sitting there very respectfully.
Yeah. And he goes on, "Gentlemen, believe me, I didn't have any ambition to play a military role, not at all. I wanted in my life a new eligible, and I am convinced that in the event of a German victory, I would have become one of the great architects in German history." Now, he's talking about had they won World War I.
Right.
He would never have had to enter politics or anything like that. He says, "I would have become one of the greatest architects in German history."
Mm-hmm.
"Regarding this, I studied, always, because for me, all of life is a complete phenomenon, not one that needs to be resolved. One cannot observe life only in an individual phenomena. I therefore studied in innumerable fields. I had no youth like other people at a time at which other people perhaps go dancing and enjoying themselves. I only learned, 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 and I also had to earn my bread on the side. I can really say, before I was 25 years old, when I entered the army as a volunteer, there was hardly a day that passed, apart from Saturday afternoon when I permitted myself a free hour, I only read and read in all fields, not just the field of architecture, but fine arts and its various styles and so forth, but rather in the field of the natural sciences, national economy as well, insofar as anybody was in a position to digest them at all at that time, in the field of politics. I described that in Mein Kampf, and I don't know why in all military fields. And then, in addition to my training as a would-be builder and occupying myself with techniques, I also read a lot. It's unbelievable how much, but I never had the ambition of becoming anything other than an architect. If this war, the World War, had ended with a German victory, you would have learned my name as one of the great German architects, never as a politician, never as the name of a man who pushed himself forward into a governmental position." You know what I like about that right there, Carolyn? It flies in the face of all this stupid preaching in classrooms about Hitler and his inherent desire to be the master over a political police state, so to speak, you know. And his actual words such as this, just tear that garbage, propaganda garbage all to hell.
Yeah.
And to me, it's good to see this.
It is. It really is. Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out.
He says, he continues, "Only in those frightful days when the collapse occurred did the decision take shape in my mind and stood before my eyes as a possibility over the course of the year 1918. It was based on the recognition that the German people would be completely unable to rise again unless there was a fundamental change in the leadership of this German people, in the organization of its society, and especially in the cleansing of this German people, in maintaining the purity of this German people." And you have a remark there.
I was just wanting to point out that I didn't think he was talking about this racially at this time.
Mm-hmm.
The German people not being united and not having a clear idea what who they were and what it meant to be who they were. And this is what, well, I think he explains it a little bit more. But I know when he says the purity of this German people, I don't think he was at all talking about the purity of their race, because this comes up later.
No, and when I read it too, Carolyn, I never took it that way either. I took it as what he's talking about is this is in the immediacy after the defeat at World War I, and so the people are beaten in their minds. Everything is bad. They've lost. They're becoming right away victims of Bolsheviks or communists.
Well, that's right. That's the thing.
To sell their wares.
That just popped into my mind. Right. It was the communist influence that was so strong at this time. That was the main problem.
Yeah, the Jewish organizations like the Spartacist movement, mm-hmm. that Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht, they took this chance to go around rabble-rousing in villages and towns in Germany and waving that red flag and telling them you're getting screwed by your German leadership and you need to change. And what they were trying to induce was a communist revolution in the country. So anyway, he goes on, he says, that was not an easy decision. I was so wrapped up in my architectural sciences and my pure studies that such a decision was unbelievably difficult. During the war, some fellows carried a Bible in their rucksack. Others carried something else. I had Schopenhauer in my rucksack throughout the entire war. I was half philosopher and half architect and concerned myself with such problems. Then I had to enter an entirely different life, which in my life I knew well, though I knew few other people, except for myself. Since few people were granted the privilege, I must say it here, to be able to move through all levels of society as I was, throughout my entire pathway of life. I grew up in a petite bourgeois family, very decent and eligible. Because of the death of my father, my parents, I had to earn my own bread. I became a worker and did everything. At the same time, I studied, learned, and had a great goal before my eyes. I wanted to become a great German architect, continuing in the tradition of Schinkel and illegible. That was my goal. I would have achieved that, too, it's quite certain, on the condition that I obtained a building license. This path stood before my eyes. I learned everything on the pathway towards this, better perhaps than any other German. I was a highly cultured man, but I stood with the proletarians in the gutter. I worked on building projects only as a laborer, and I got to know construction workers. Like few other people, I became familiar with social problems, not from the party viewpoint, but rather from the most elementary side. I saw this problem from the point of view of the education of this broad mass, in their standard of living, their squalid misery, their insecurity, but also in recognition of their inner toughness, their steadfastness, their solidity, their possible capacity for enthusiasm. I saw all that as a soldier and got to know it a second time. Beautiful paragraph there, because that paragraph right there virtually for me explains why communism was unable to triumph in Germany and why it was beaten back. Because when he said he was associated with the proletariat and got down in there and dug those ditches and worked with those people and their insecurities, their misery, he learned them and he learned what they were thinking. And what that did, Carolyn, for me was to enable him to counter the communists who were trying to convert that very mass against what they call the bourgeoisie or the upper classes, the aristocracy.
Right, because they didn't have anything better than he had for the
yes.
people.
Right.
With his national socialism.
Right. When the war came to this tragic end for Germany, I had to first say goodbye to my only great passion in this life, and I decided, based on my living experience, to undertake the reorganization of a new German racial corpus, Volkskörper, a more or less uniquely National Socialist word. And then he says, I'm not sure whether racial corpus is really a correct translation.
It's actually a folk body, or the body of the people.
Yeah, that's what he says. I say body of the people, already something different from what many other German politicians had in mind. The bourgeois politicians only saw the state before their eyes. I saw the people, the substance. For me, the state was nothing more than a purely exterior, even a compulsory form, Zwangsform. I had then already come to see that that which we call the state is in reality the overcoming of the inborn individualistic self-drive in people, that one can't start anything with the state, especially in reorganizing rather that the body of the people was the primary and decisive thing, that the body of the people must therefore be reorganized.
Now, I think this is real important, because we hear this talk a lot from, in white nationalism today, and going back quite a ways, that this individualism is one of our problems as white people, and that keeps us from thinking of ourselves as a whole people and doing what's best for ourselves as a people, which is exactly right. What Hitler introduced at that time. He called it the state because he was talking about Germany, and that he wanted to encourage the idea that the state came first, and not in a totalitarian sense, but in the idea that we are the state and we are the people, and we need to think of ourselves as the body of the people, the total people, not as so much as individuals.
True. Yeah. The Fuhrer continues, I threw myself into this problem and this struggle began, but now, gentlemen, with what chance of success? And here I must tell you something for the first time. On the day that I appeared before a few followers for the first time and communicated my thoughts to them, on that day I was convinced that I could one day become leader of the German Reich. Since then, I never doubted for a second that I would lead the German state and with it the entire German nation one day. No one came to me in the years 1920, 21, 22, and was ever told anything other than, one day the hour will come in which the flag I carry will be the German flag, in which the principles which I have laid down will be the basic principles of the German state. That was the prognosis of a man at that time who had nothing going for him except his own inner faith. I had neither a name nor capital. I had no press, no protection, nothing. I had only enemies who considered me either mentally ill or a fool or a criminal. The communists and left-wing radicals called me a criminal. The bourgeois considered me a crazy man. That was how I was judged as a personality. And despite all this, I had the conviction that at the end of this struggle, I would emerge as absolute victor. At this time, many followers came to me as if propelled. Many of them are sitting here now, and at this time, the Reichsmarschall came too. Though he found himself in a very small framework, he was convinced that our beginning would probably win, because it had to win.
You know, and here he's indicating, he's not actually saying so, he doesn't have to, but how important it was to his movement when Göring,
yes,
who he's referring to as the Reichsmarschall, joined him in that.
That's exactly
and
right.
It was because Göring had a lot of, he had a good reputation, he had a lot of contacts, and he brought a lot with him. I know there are people today who are a little bit on a different side of the fence who see Göring as a bad influence in the long run, but certainly Hitler was really grateful to him, and he participated. You know, he was very active, let me say. Göring was very active right from the beginning.
Right, he was on the front lines.
Yeah, there. Yeah.
I mention that, gentlemen, generals, and officers, to make it clear to you that if a man has chosen such a life's path, defeats of the kind that we are experiencing today cannot bother me at all. That cannot shake me. The only thing that often affects me personally are inner difficulties. Enemies can never crush me, never. In my whole life, I never had to do or could do anything else other than swim against a tremendously powerful current. I swam against this current, and I was often pulled back again much faster. In the end, however, I was repeatedly able to produce success. And why? Because I was convinced that in the long run, a correct, basically correct conviction put forth fanatically and tenaciously must lead to success. At the same time, I must also stress something else. I place higher value, higher than on so-called understanding of an intellectual kind, higher even than genius, on stubbornness, stubborn tenaciousness, pursuing a cause once recognized as correct to the last breath, and never to give way under any circumstances, and to shrink from nothing. I consider that the highest human virtue. And what that certainly defines there, Carolyn, is his directives to his military to hold firm, never give up. Mm-hmm. And you know, and sometimes he's criticized for that because they're saying, well, he should have directed these forces to evacuate, retreat, instead of telling them, hold on to what you got. That's just a minor part of it. But what he's telling you there is if you waver, and he as the leader of the people, if he wavers any, the whole thing collapses like a house of cards. But he didn't waver, and therefore it took the entire damn world 6 years to crush his country, the combination of all the powers in the world to beat what he had going.
You know, I like the way that he uses fanatically. I like that he's not afraid to use the word fanatically.
That's right. That's right. He doesn't.
It's not a bad word.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, you have to be. You have to be absolutely convinced and in a sense then fanatic about what you're doing.
When I made this decision in 1918 and looked where I would be able to start, I plunged into the literature of my youth, which was not available to me in my war years. I devoured Marxist literature, studied Das Kapital once again, to recall all its weaknesses to memory. I also formed the concept of a new worldview for the new movement. Now, this word worldview is in the mouths of innumerable people even then and will continue to be mentioned. But let me ask you right here, Carolyn, is he talking about the word that I've read that's, I think it's pronounced Weltanschauung?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. But I must tell you quite briefly what a worldview really is. It's a definition which, in my view, is quite necessary, since, as I said, the word is used too strongly and, in the end, no longer meant anything certain or definite. Worldview is nothing other than a way of considering all the problems of this existence according to scientific knowledge insofar as is available to us today. That means I judge the problems of life in such a way as scientific knowledge permits us to do today, and whether that's an eternal truth may be left undecided for the moment. But there was a time when men were so far developed in their ability to perceive that when they recognized that the lights in the firmament were moving lights, they were convinced that everything stood still. The earth, which already in the ancient age was recognized as a globe by the Greeks, stands, and the moving lights meant that the earth was the center of the world.
Yeah, well, let's stop here for a second. Now, you know, it shows again, just like in the table talk, how much he admires scientific knowledge. He's very forward-thinking, and he's also admiring people in the ancient world and the great thinkers of that time. How he says they were men who were able to perceive. How did he say that? They were able to see things probably better than we do today. And they came up with these ideas, which were based on their own great brain power and observing what was going on around them. And as he points out that the ancient Greeks already recognized that the earth was a globe.
It was a round, a globe,
So, and then, you know, there's more of this, but, and he, you know, we know that he was in the habit of talking about this astronomy and the Ptolemaic system and so on.
Yeah. This Ptolemaic system was a worldview. It was incorrect, but it was an incredible step forward for humanity as compared to the stupid primitive manners of observation, let's say that of any Negro tribe living today. Then one day, over the course of centuries, a new, better science gains an insight. And this Ptolemaic system of an Aristotle was overthrown by the genius of a Copernicus, wherein a new picture of the world arose. It no longer places the earth at the center of the world, but rather allows this earth as a planet to travel in a circle. Even this is in the meantime out of date, since even the sun is not a fixed sun which stands still, but rather it moves too within the framework of the Milky Way system. The latter moves as a gigantic fog in some definite direction or other, according to a star system which is understood today, or at least one thinks. Powerful stuff here. I think the impression he's trying to say is that The smart men of centuries ago came up with observations that were then made a worldview and accepted as being the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But because science, the nature of science is to continue to seek, keep learning and investigating, and then a new picture emerges, and it overcomes one that's been in force for 3, 4, 5 centuries, and a whole new viewpoint has to be formed. And to Hitler, of course, and all of us really that can think, this is a tremendous step forward that we didn't stay where we were. We moved on because of science and because we didn't reject science as being something anti-religious or something like this. I think that's part of what he's trying to say.
Well, yeah, and it just occurred to me, he probably is comparing this to his National Socialism.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of these officers were not strong National Socialists.
Yes.
He's showing how this happens and when new things come about, and that his National Socialism, he firmly believed, was the new political movement of the time. Nothing better would come along for a long, long time. And I don't think it has yet.
Right, I agree. Mm-hmm. The Fuhrer goes on. Thus, scientific knowledge changes itself. The decisive thing is, for one to make the latest state of scientific knowledge one's own and observe life's problems from that point of view. It very often happens that that which men grasp as knowledge had already been grasped instinctively by men in prehistory. But over the course of many centuries and often millennia, men lose their natural instincts, especially through unnatural racial crossings, and that only afterwards on the path to a scientific recognition can the correctness of the earlier instinctive views be reestablished. That is, a consideration of the entire event around us from the point of view of the most recent scientific knowledge. This necessarily leads to the following conclusions. Conclusion. If I recognize a view to be correct, then not only do I have a duty to communicate this perception to my fellow citizens in a state, but also to eliminate contrary perceptions. That may seem intolerant, but, gentlemen officers, all of life is intolerant. This is the lesson of nature. Nature is intolerant against everything that is not correct, and therefore weak, in which case weaklings primarily become extinguished by themselves. Nature already eliminates, in the illegible struggle, the damaged and the weak. Bitches immediately push weak puppies who want to suck away from themselves. Why? We do not know, but she allows it to die, cruelly as we human beings believe. In reality, however, such perishing is full of profound insight.
Well, now, there's a couple of things you might want to speak about this too, but in the previous paragraph, he said that when men lose their natural instincts, especially through unnatural racial crossings. So here is one instance where he is, you might say, condemning unnatural
race mixing,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in this current paragraph, he goes into that again. But I think this idea really took hold of this. And he brings it up several times, but I think it's such a powerful idea, and I brought it up during kind of like arguments with other people, that Hitler says, and he says it a number of times, that his duty is not only to discover what is the best way to do things, but to eliminate contrary ways that other people have, to actually get rid of, which goes totally against the idea that we need to have all these different points of view, and we all can have our own point of view, and somehow the best one is going to come out and people will vote for that person or whatever. You know, but that's not his view at all. That's why when we
say
he wasn't a Democrat, he really wasn't a Democrat.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, I think that's it. He says this again. He says it here in this next paragraph, so.
Right. Going on, he says, it is madness to imagine today that political views must be tolerant. Tolerance is only understandable as signs of inner insecurity. The moment that I am completely certain of a problem, not only do I have the right to communicate the problem or this attitude, but rather the duty to eliminate the other. attitudes. I must take a leap here to the point of view of an officer. When I say this as a politician, then, I'm expressing something which forms the natural basis of an officer's whole activity, since an officer can use everything except a tolerant point of view. That means that he, too, must recognize a problem, a task, a necessity, and then he has not only the right to obey this necessity, but the duty to ruthlessly eliminate everything else. Every officer will be faced with this task in the course of his leadership. Now, that's a wonderful lesson right there, that the military cannot function, the officer cannot be, cannot succeed in his duties if this tolerant viewpoint is pushed on everybody. Mm-hmm. Hitler says, I might give you an example here. Let's take one problem away from you. There are innumerable people who say, we belong to such and such a religious sect. This sect forbids us to kill. We'll become soldiers, but we won't kill anybody. That was an earlier problem that an officer had to deal with. On the one hand, based on his acceptance that our life is an eternal struggle, it is his duty to train the men entrusted to him for battle. But here, based on purely theoretical and, for all I care, completely respectable principles, a man comes up to him and says, I refuse to do that. I won't kill anybody, but I can work in a room somewhere. Now the officer stands faced with the question of dealing with that man. But at this point, they made the most cowardly decision that you can possibly imagine. They said, a man who won't fight, doesn't want to shoot, we can't use him. And as a result, the guy isn't even armed. So he ceases to exist. In other words, we capitulate here in the face of one single guy so as to avoid resolving a conflict. Today, the state relieves you of this that is foreign to the state. It takes the view that since life is a struggle, an eternal struggle, a principle which every officer must adopt as his own, otherwise he can't be an officer, a man who doesn't want to shoot is unfit to live, is therefore eliminated, ruthlessly eliminated. The officer, despite the pre-selection which on the grounds of our worldview can isolate or destroy the man who refuses to shoot on ideological grounds, can also find himself in the same situation over the course of the struggle. That means a time may come when the coward, like any other ulcer, suddenly begins the inner poisoning of others. And at this point, the officer, for his part, finds himself faced with the same problem all over again. You can understand it. One can even understand the individual man. You can say, he hasn't eaten for so long now. He's completely bedraggled, exhausted, hasn't had any sleep. And nevertheless, one must find the hardness in the interest of maintaining the armed forces, even just the company or the platoon, to proceed and to break the man concerned unmercifully if necessary, so that the nation may not be broken. Well, I was going to say that the old common adage that comes to all of that broken down, it says, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And that's how I translated that right there. And if you adopt a tolerant attitude and say, okay, this conscientious objector, he won't even take up a rifle or whatever, but you know, maybe we can use him doing this, that, and the other. And what that does is weaken your chain.
Well, right, and then how many others say, oh, look, there's a way to get out of this.
I can get out of this.
And when you're in bad battle, probably everybody would like to get out of it.
Certainly.
in hard battle. But this is something that nobody says because it doesn't sound good.
That's right. It sounds so cruel.
And we have to understand that people are different. These people would never end up in the army, but the idea was if you're a citizen of that state, all males are called up, you are going to be called up, and you're going to serve. So I think what he says, no matter unmercifully and so on, would be that these men who refuse to fight would be executed quite often. I don't know if they all would be, but, or what the situation was, but.
Right.
Nobody likes to talk about these things, I know that.
No. And, you know, this reminded me of recently I saw I watched the movie again, the old Turner classic movies, Patton.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember that movie, you remember the scene there, he goes into the tent where all of those wounded men were laying there, some of them dying and whatever, and then there's this guy says, I can't go anymore, General, my nerves, and he proceeds to slap the guy and whatever.
Oh.
And Patton had that very same philosophy that is being expressed right here.
Mm-hmm. And that's how you have a winning, that's how you win.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, in your profession, it becomes clear, as it can possibly be, that knowledge not only entails a duty to educate, but also, if necessary, a duty to destroy. That is, that officers are also obligated to eliminate those who resist such an education. There is no tolerance in nature. Nature, if I take tolerance as a human concept, is the most intolerant thing that exists. It destroys everything that is unfit for life. Whatever is not willing to defend itself or unable to do so is destroyed, and we are only a speck of dust in this nature. Man is nothing more than a small bacteria or a little bacillus on such a planet. When a creature attempts to escape these laws, it doesn't change the laws. Rather, it ends its existence. I therefore introduce this principle into the political life of Germany. It's not new, since Bolshevism has long possessed these laws, but even Christianity has possessed this knowledge. I must point out to you, gentlemen, it is not an unchristian principle, that which I represent here. Christendom destroyed other people who did not wish to think in the prescribed way, just not so simply and quickly as we do, but more slowly. We do it with a bullet. And there they did it using fire, they burned them. Therefore, that is a principle which in itself was already introduced earlier. I've recognized that one must also anchor this principle in the reconstruction of a strong German state. Good and correct knowledge is not enough as the basis of the new education, but also the willingness to intolerantly destroy those who resist or will not accept.
Mm-hmm.
And that flies in the face of what Ms. Clark says about his growing more tolerant. That right there sure nails it.
Yeah. I just want to bring up one more thing that I missed from back when, but it was same subject here. When he's talking about nature and how nature is intolerant against everything that is not correct and therefore weak. And that stands out to me, too. It's like if something is born that's not right, it's not the way it actually is intended to be, the way it's supposed to be. It's weak. It's something that's weak.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, of course, taught that we must take care of the weak and so on, and we create more
right.
and more of these weak things. This is God's work or something, and we're supposed to look after them, all of this. Well, again, we had the situation in National Socialist Germany where they had the eugenics program. The eugenics program, which is such an important program, such a worthwhile program, to help prevent this kind of thing from continuing on, things being born that weren't right.
Good. So, I have now begun to experiment in our own movement. This movement has been accused of being completely intolerant, but precisely because of this, because it obeyed a law of nature, it succeeded in achieving total victory in only 15 years, although the point of departure was as unpromising as it could possibly be. At the head, a leader who was completely unknown, poor, without a name, no press available, no good names available, no sympathy on any side, etc. And nevertheless, it succeeded in leading this movement to victory. The proof of this is that here as well, the basic belief was correct, and that the implementation of this measure was correct as well. When the final collapse occurred, and I was convinced that the results of the collapse could be eliminated not by forming just one new party along with the others, or giving some bourgeois party a new injection of fighting spirit, I made my decision. Later I was often asked, "Why didn't you go over to some bourgeois party?" Gentlemen, when a fighting group fails completely today, then it's completely bad. It makes no sense to try to restore order in that unit. Rather, you dissolve the unit and build something completely new. I was of the same conviction, since followers and leadership must be born out of the same spirit.
That's a great statement right there that would make for a nice saying, sure. Followers and leadership must be born out of the same spirit.
Exactly. Often, people have confronted me with, why didn't you join one of the other parties? After all, the bourgeois parties are against Marxism, too. They can use your abilities. My abilities, yes, but I had no congenial leadership, and it had to be built up. I needed an apparatus capable of reacting to my orders, and the apparatus could only react if it arose from the same spiritual background upon which the leader was building. That meant they had to understand that in the multi-party state, there's nothing more to wish or hope for, as no fundamental reform is possible. This collapse was not the result of military decay or disintegration. Rather, it was the result of the disintegration of the body of the German people, an inner disintegration, which was naturally reflected on the front as well. While armies often collapse under the effects of overwhelmingly superior enemy forces or enemy weapons, but can be brought back into proper order by the hardness of a properly led homeland, with us during the World War, it happened the other way around. You couldn't count on solving the problem with a few minor improvements in one party or another. You needed a new body of the German people, a reorganization of the body of the people, and secondly, at the same time, you needed a deliberate struggle against degeneration. At the same time, then, a decision had to be made, namely, was the collapse of 1918 the end of the German nation? This was many people's attitude, wasn't it? Or was it, and this was my conviction, the beginning of a new body of the people? Didn't we really need this collapse in order to liquidate a state of affairs which was intolerable in the long run anyway? I must speak of the reasons for this very briefly. They lay mainly somewhat deeper than was generally visible. And even these problems are not suitable for discussion before the broad masses of the German people. In our country, we have a people that cannot be considered comparable or equivalent to a race, something that is perhaps already clear to millions of people. But gentlemen, when I began my educational process almost 25 years ago, it wasn't this way, but rather many bourgeois groups repeatedly criticized me, saying, people and race are the same. No, people and race aren't the same. Race is a blood component. It's the blood-based nucleus. But the people very often consist not of one race, but of 2, 3, 4, or 5 different racial nuclei. Nevertheless, it is not possible and not desirable to dissolve such a body of the people. But such a solution can occur over the course of political developments.
Now, this is the key paragraph that Ms. Clark works with in her interpretation of this speech. And I just want to say two things here, that when he says, we have a people that cannot be considered comparable to a race, that word race is used such as, the Chinese race or very different kinds of races, not the differences between Europeans so much. But then he also says, when I began my educational process almost 25 years ago, many bourgeois groups repeatedly criticized me, saying people and race are the same. So he's indicating that even 25 years ago, he was criticized for saying that people and race are not the same. So this is not a new idea that he had, because she's putting out that this is some new change in his thinking, which is so significant. Yep. But it's not a new idea when he says he was saying this 25 years ago. He's still saying it today, but it's taken people a longer time to catch up because they have this fixed idea about how you interpret the word race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. True. Good point.
Yeah, I thought so.
When one regards the German people from this point of view as purely biological, then we see a union of peoples with the same language consolidated through the circuitous route of state formation. That is perhaps the decisive thing here, but of various racial origins. A Nordic racial nucleus, but Alpine elements are present as well. Also, Mediterranean racial nuclei, with a still European base race in it all, a prehistoric race, which we are no longer able to identify specifically, but which is there. It was already there among the Greeks. The helots of the Spartans consisted of them. This racial nucleus lies concealed in our people as well.
Okay, let me point out here, if I may, that he
sure.
is speaking of five. He's using five different racial nuclei: Nordic, mm-hmm. Alpine, Mediterranean, which all makes sense for Germans. Then the European base race, which has been talked about by people who go into European ancient races and so on. And then the prehistoric, which still shows up, and that you can't have a name for that, but prehistorical he calls it. So that's five of them. He's not talking about, he doesn't bring up anything else, anything more foreign
that's
or
right.
different than that. And he says that this has been in existence in Europeans for a long time. Now, speaking of the Mediterranean, I'll just bring up that you knew Wilhelm Christmann pretty well, and he always talked about he had Mediterranean in him, and he thought it was good. He thought it added something to his ethnic makeup. But yeah, you know, you can find that in you find certain amounts of it in all these things are mixed together. Well, he's going to get into why he likes the Nordic as we go on here. So,
yes.
Okay.
Good. So we see a people that consists of various racial nuclei. These racial nuclei in the individual possess their special abilities. Since the abilities lie not primarily in the people, rather they lie primarily in the race. That the German people now possesses many racial nuclei is shown, in the end, by the richness of its abilities, since all these racial nuclei carry certain inclinations in themselves. The Nordic racial nucleus are very coolly inclined, mathematically proficient factor, the factor which until now generally organized countries on the earth, basically organizational. In addition, other racial nuclei with a strongly artistic gift, with a gift for the purely visual, the pictorial. Then again, racial nuclei with a strongly musical gift, as well as racial nuclei with a strong commercial gift. The strongest of these racial nuclei, which possessed such a commercial gift without creative activity in the German people long term, would be Jewry. Only with the difference that this Jewry did not arise as a racial nucleus among the German people, but rather that it would have gradually but completely disintegrated the German people. We have now united this racial nucleus in our people, but it is now decisive for me, since the abilities of the German people are so great, to bring forth the leading racial nucleus among the various abilities. That means I must see that in the case of artistic abilities, the racial nucleus that is most artistically gifted in the German people gradually comes to take a leading role everywhere. Now, gentlemen, this won't occur as the result of a deliberate selection, as if I had said, who looks artistic? Rather, at this point, the miraculous phenomenon appears that music, in the end, finds its representative. That means if I hit a certain note, then the string on the piano, which is tuned to that note, makes its appearance. And if I need proof of a certain ability and allow free development to do its work, the elements who are really tuned for it naturally appear, based on their racial inclinations. This is decisive because for the leadership of a people, only the Nordic racial component has any real value. In the overall selection, this will always result in a uniform picture, but one must not assume a uniform picture in nature, since nature shows us here that in the crossing of two different parents, the talents or abilities of the son must not always come from the father, or in the case of the daughter, from the mother. Rather, on the contrary, cross connections must appear here, so that if a Nordic man marries an Alpine woman, the child of the same sex need not be Nordic, rather it can be completely Alpine, so that it is also very easily possible in any racial crossing for the organizational talent to be completely pushed into the background in favor of any other talent. But if I have an organization of society based on purely capitalistic development, which has nothing to do with Nordic leadership talents, and it builds an upper crust, then it can happen that the upper crust gradually represents completely non-Nordic people who are mentally completely unfit for leadership.
Well, I think that's really interesting.
That struck me like a ton of bricks. When I read that here a while back, Carolyn, it's like he is defining the United States today right on the money. Tel Aviv West, which a lot of people call Washington, D.C., an organization of society based on purely capitalistic development. It hasn't really anything to do with Nordic leadership talents, but it builds this upper crust, which is Judaic, and it can happen then that the upper crust then gradually represents completely non-Nordic people who are mentally completely unfit for leadership because they have been converted to this Jewish ethos.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the inner conflict that is really tearing at the United States. We are a primarily non-Jewish nation being directed to, by, and for the Jewish ethos.
Well, yeah. What I wanted to point out was that he sees the organizational ability, which is the key to leadership. I mean, if you're going to be a leader, you have to be able to organize especially well and organize things for people to follow you. And he sees that, he thinks, I don't know if that's exactly proven, but that the Nordic has that ability to the greatest degree. And he's saying that for Germany now, he thinks that is the most crucial, the most important, because he sees Germany as becoming the leading nation of Europe, and the Germans as taking on all these leadership roles in even far-flung places. And they have to be prepared to do this. He's trying to prepare them to do that, and he sees that the Nordic quality, the Nordic racial element, is the most important for that. But not that that he would want Germany to be all Nordic, or that it's the most important element of Germans. It's just most important because he wants to create leaders to carry on with what his plans are here, which I think is, very good. If that had happened, wow, we would have such a different world today, and everything would be so much better. For our people, anyway,
True.
You know, it would be so much
True.
Better for
yeah.
us, for all European peoples. But instead we have what you just said, the Jewish control.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Instead of that.
That Jewish ethos of greed, materialism, that's the American dream, and that's just...
Right. And he's saying that in this system, it's all money, so that you have the leading... industrialists and people with money and so on, and then their children inherit that, and they inherit the positions of power. They're the ones who are chosen. They're sent to the best schools, and they're put in these governmental leadership positions and all kinds of leadership positions, and they may be totally unfit for it because they don't have the right qualities. Yeah?
Right.
And he says then, that this was the tragedy of the old Reich.
Yeah. Okay, he goes into that. He says, that was the tragedy of the old German Reich. Here one could have the following experience, and I've often seen this. Stopped on the highway at any construction site along with two other cars, in one of which sat a rich Saxon industrialist, in the other another rich man who one could immediately see at a glance had, of course, not the slightest Nordic admixture. And the street worker by his side, let's say anywhere in North Germany, the fantastic phenomena of the street worker's absolute contempt for the passengers of such a car, complete contempt, this street worker was in himself more fit to lead than the one that's sitting in the car. I can observe that politically. Naturally, if I look at it from a purely material point of view, like that of a pharmacist or a twine manufacturer, or from the point of view of a musician or a poet or a painter, then naturally you get a completely different picture. People have sought out ordinary life in this manner. It is not intended as something to be prescribed for you as by a pharmacist. It's not something transplanted into an economy. Rather, life attracts those who are suited for it. But in political life, it's different. Those who've come into wealth through some economic process have sent their children off to gain higher education, The inclinations of a child are just like those of his parents. Their common temperament is a purely commercial one. But because of his education, he now joins the political ruling classes. Then we have parties composed of people from the bourgeoisie. But this bourgeoisie is not primarily a racial term, but rather primarily a purely economic concept. This bourgeoisie is composed largely of these elements, and the great danger is that slowly, through upbringing, which gradually becomes a work of art more than a real education or better training, now generation after generation grows up, and gradually they send representatives of themselves in all sectors as well, including even the officer corps, and in this manner the apparatus comes to be politically and militarily saturated with elements which would not normally be meant for it, who wouldn't even normally feel suited for it, and who invariably fail the first critical stress test. This produces those umbrella patriots with their top hats who wish to face off a dangerous crowd. People tell me, look, you can't do that by force. You have to do that with intellect. That is, the people who possess the least amount of intellect themselves, who were never in a position to solve the problem themselves, capitulate before the slightest hullabaloo. As far as I'm concerned, they forgot that there is enough strength in our people to start immediately taking care of such common riffraff who combined political with criminal ideology and drive them off. In just a few years, I succeeded in driving these people completely off the streets, but only because of a new leadership corps. When I told them, nobody gets into this party just because he's got a business, or can show that he's got a certain amount of money, or high-class parents. Rather, in this party, you rise to leadership if you're able to lead. Nobody cares where you came from, and this leadership ability is in demand and further trained. But in order to implement this deliberately, gentlemen, officers, and generals, I take all elements out of the body of the people who are somehow, let's say, capable of forming the starting point of a contrary movement. So in my party, I have always made it a duty, since the very beginning, to look whether a man has showed some leadership talent somewhere. And this talent must be immediately drawn up and incorporated into the leadership of the state to eliminate the Spartacus types, namely the unrecognized geniuses, who will then one day, because they weren't deliberately inserted into the leadership from above, think they are capable of leadership by themselves and get the masses into their hands in no time because of their great leadership abilities, since the masses, for their part, understand immediately who's capable of leadership and who isn't. Any school child understands that. You take a class of 10-year-olds, enthusiastic, tough kids, and you put a teacher in that class who isn't any good. The teacher has no idea how useless he is, but these kids know exactly. And when you give them a real leader, and you'll see that these kids who are busy making their teacher's life miserable, and that's a law of nature, and I've got to say, they've been tormenting him and annoying him, the other one, but they'll not only follow this other one, but they will do anything for him. Now, that's an experience that I've had all over the country, especially in the armed forces, in which a leader is worshipped and can achieve anything with his soldiers, while another, who can't keep shop, can't maintain the slightest discipline. And why? Because this other one, he's not eligible, our leader, not him. They reject him instinctively. If a company is bad, it's not because the men are bad, but because the leadership is failing in some way. And that's true for any military unit. Building up the body of the people in such a way so that the people with real leadership ability get to the top of the political leadership, that's what counts. To do this, gentlemen, I've eliminated every precondition for a subsequent revolution. I've done that, of course, in a gigantic way, first by building up the movement and then the German people. For this reason, you've got to look at my program in a different way, not like a purely bourgeois intellectual party leader. People have often told me, why do you use such a radical tone in your program? Because I need radical people. They told me, look, if you leave out this one point, then I'll become a member right away. And my answer is, that point is in there so that you can't become a member because I don't want you. And then it says, great applause. And if I'd have been there, I'd have gave him a standing ovation. Now he says, I rejected a lot of people, people I didn't want. I prevented innumerable people from entering the party because I saw how they lived. They had never been leaders because I knew perfectly well what I could expect from them. It's no good to you bringing weak people into your leadership. Rather, the time will come when even just a few can cause endless trouble. Of course, there have been problems on the other side, too. It's been that way all my life. The gray hair I've got now came from the inner struggle alone. What problems my own men have caused me. They've all got rough edges. When you get three or four of them together and leave them alone for a moment, they start stabbing each other in the back. Then it starts all over again, nothing but trouble. I'd like to see things like that in the Army. Just problems, just hard men, and so on. But you know, I prefer people who, under normal circumstances, when it thunders a bit outside, they make their own thunder to answer back, because I know when it starts to thunder, they'll all stand there firm as blocks of granite. And I've been proven right. Everybody's got to admit that the leadership of this movement is different from the earlier governmental leadership. Just imagine any of the old bourgeois leaderships instead of the leadership of the German people we've got now, and then let them suffer the stresses of the German nation today. You'd be amazed. Today's leadership not only got through the World War, but repeated it under 10 times worse conditions. And what were the stresses of the World War compared to the stresses we've got to endure today? When you get twice as many deaths in a single night in a city like Hamburg as in a month on all the German fronts put together, and the same city goes almost 100% back to work and all the women come streaming back into the city and everything takes place in perfect order, then that's proof of the correctness of the way we've built up our leadership. Enthusiastic applause.
Yeah. Oh, that was great reading, Ray.
Well, thank you.
Now, we're about a little over halfway through this talk, and we covered a lot of subjects, but it's all leading to something. But we covered that whole part about, that's supposed to be a part about his views on race and the German, the German people being a mixed race or something, or having many racial elements, so therefore he was, this was supposedly new and surprising and very, very significant. But as we noted, he talked about it before. It's even in some of the National Socialist writings on race that have been published and so on. And so this is, in this whole speech, this little part that we already have already covered is all there is that supposedly makes this his most significant speech.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we know that I don't think he said anything here so far that he has not said before. Although I don't know where he said that thing about it's my duty, when I totally believe that something is the right way to go, it's my duty also to get rid of what is the opposite of that or what opposes that. I don't know that I'd heard that or where he said that before. Do you recall that in Table Talk?
You know, I thought about that. I don't think it rang a bell with me in that sense, you know. So
yeah, that might be something new, although it probably isn't, because he's pretty much said so many things. He's had, you know, kind of themes and ways he's talked throughout the many years. So we're going to find out in our next program that we're going to do what else he has to say. And it's very interesting, too. Is there any way you want to sum up what we've done today?
Well, just simply to say what I said at the start, that this is an extremely positive lesson. It's a lot like Table Talk, but it's a bit more, that, you know, when he's made remarks, and you know Hitler was always wanting to speak to the people, and he values the people so much, and yet in this, he's wise enough to say, these are things that you can't really say to the masses. Mm-hmm. And so he's differentiating here, and he's talking about his leadership core, and he talks about weaknesses and that can seep in and destroy your movements. And he defines exactly how you keep that from happening. And he comes there at the end and says, Hamburg has been bombed and we've suffered more casualties then than in a month's worth of date in the war, and the previous war. And he says, and yet the leadership holds up. People rush back into that destroyed city and try to get things going again. Mm-hmm. And how well it speaks for the German people acting as a people, as a unified.
That's because they had leadership. And that was leadership exactly that he put into place with the Gauleiters, and they were all National Socialists, and they believed in the program, and they believed in what they were doing, and people followed them then because they led the way. And boy, it was true. They never had a people who lived there would say how there was not this negative anguish going on, particularly, although it was very hard, very hard. But of course, a lot of people were grieving and so on. But people had a positive viewpoint. So Hitler had instilled that. And he had mm-hmm. the people in place, and that's what comes across to me about this as he talks about leadership and how he was working on that, how important it was to set up all these training programs and schools and so on, which would create the leaders that they needed to have. And he was preparing Germany to lead Europe so that Europe would have good leadership, not just mm-hmm. to elevate Germany, but to give the proper leadership to Europe. Against Bolshevism and all of that. So it's really great. Now I'm going to ask you a tough question to finish off with. And how would you judge at this point that the officers that he's talking to are receiving what he's saying?
In my opinion, I think very, very positively. That would be my take, because it's dark days. These men have been at the front, and then he sits and he talks with them. Sits and talks with them, doesn't stand at a podium and preach to them. He sits and shares these things with them. And I think that it's a lifting experience for the officer corps, the generals that are there.
Yeah, I tend to think that way too. There are always going to be some people in there who are going to be thinking bad things, are not going to be going along with it. But overall, I think the applause was no doubt genuine. And there seemed to have been quite a bit of it, and even some calls out. Maybe they came in the second part, you know, where they shouted out something.
Sure.
So, well, it takes a lot of courage. Just this one talk here makes me think how much courage Hitler had to always mm-hmm. face up to do what he needed to do, and to stand mm-hmm. behind what he believed was right. Not too many people can do it, probably so very few, and he was one of the very. I'll just let it go at that. We will be back in next week, and we'll do part two of this interesting talk. Thanks a lot, Ray.
Hey, my boy, thank you.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you later. Bye for now.